Adamo pacitam vitam.
Adamo pacitam vitam.
Haranyam, haranyam lipamedasa.
Haranyam lipamedasa.
Sambojaniya padasai.
Sambojaniya padasai.
Jalani va jala kasaha.
Jalani va jala kasaha.
Adamo pachitam vitam.
Adamo pachitam vitam.
Herant yanye lipamedasa.
Herant yanye lipamedasa.
Sambho janiya padasai.
Sambho janiya padasai.
Jalani va jalakasau. Adamo pachitam vitam.
Adamo pachitam vitam.
Haranyanye lipamedasa.
Haranyanye lipamedasa.
Sambojaniya padasai.
Sambojaniya padasai.
Jalani va jalakasa.
Jalani va jalakasa.
Upachitam.
Upachitam.
Gathered. Vitam,
vitam,
wealth.
Wealth.
Haranti,
haranti,
steel.
Anye,
other persons.
Alpamedasaha,
of one who is unintelligent.
Sambojaniya,
as requiring support. Apadeshai, by the false designations. Jalani, water. Eva, as. Jala okasaha, of a resident of the water. Translation and purport by the disciples of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In the guise of dear dependents, strangers steal the sinfully acquired wealth of a foolish man, just as the offspring of a fish drink up the water that sustains the fish. Purport. Ordinary people feel they cannot live without their wealth, although their possession of it is circumstantial and temporary. Just as wealth gives life to an ordinary man, water gives life to a fish. One's dear dependents, however, steal one's wealth, just as a fish's offspring drink up the water sustaining the fish. In the words of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, this world is a weird abode. Om Gyana Tivinandasya Gnanjina Shilakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jena Tasmay Shri Guruve Namaha. Vancha kalpa truvyascha kripa sindubhyeva cha titanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Garadhara Sri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Translation again. In the guise of their dependents, strangers steal the sinfully acquired wealth of a foolish man, just as the offspring of a fish drink up the water that sustains the fish. So, is this a negative verse? Is it negative about material existence? Many people have that idea of the devotees, that they're very negative, and perhaps not unrightly, because certainly devotees have an aspiration to look at reality as it is, and sometimes, you know, depending on how much the devotee has assimilated that, he will have a different sort of attitude and response to material nature, and sometimes it's very critical, and sometimes angry or bitter. But also, even the mature devotees, like the devotees here in Srimad Bhagavatam, Akrura, they are also criticizing material nature. And the not so much criticizing, but looking at it in a negative way. So, is this right or is this wrong? Because many people will say, you know, it's one should maintain a positive outlook. One should be positive and optimistic. That is psychologically healthy. To be overly negative or doubtful is an unhappy state of consciousness. It doesn't do anybody any good. Because, of course, the goal of life is to be happy. So, Prabhupada, this one quote from Prabhupada that my Gurudev likes to give about when he was first coming along. You know, he'd read a lot of Prabhupada's books and had been hanging out at the temple. He still had his fiancée at the time. Obviously, that never happened. But he had his fiancée, and they went to the temple, and they were sitting in front of Prabhupada, and Prabhupada was exceedingly fired up. And he was on the Vyasa stand, roaring. He says, "If you are a human being, you must be pessimistic. To be optimistic about material life is animal life." Roaring this. And of course, Gurudev, he was relishing. He was saying, "Yes, I can see the reality behind these words." Because he was a sincere seeker of the truth. And one who is a sincere seeker of the truth, they appreciate a dose of reality. They appreciate the illusion being cut away. But at the same time, his fiance was sitting there and she was freaking out. What is my husband-to-be getting involved in? You know, I can see a bright future with us together. You know, we can we'll have a house and a family and children, and it'll be so nice. Optimistic. And here was Prabhupada, you know, preaching to her husband-to-be in a very fired-up tone, and he was relishing. So it was disturbing for her. And sometimes, you know, young devotees, you know, they can be particularly fired up about the negatives, especially young men, brahmacharis. You know, it said that brahmacharis should meditate on two things, passing and the miseries of material existence. Because these things drive home the reality of this material world. So, really, for a devotee, we must make the pursuit of truth our goal. Not simply that we want to band together around some positive values, and say Hari Bol and have a nice social club. That should be there. I mean, social relations in devotional society should be nice and sweet. But at the same time, truth should be the ultimate goal. Not that we maintain illusory optimism about the material energy. Because what that will do is make our a spiritual desire, our spiritual determination, weak. Because we'll be thinking, you know, this world isn't so bad. Ravindra Sharup, he likes to joke, you know, the goal of the Krishna consciousness movement is to go back to Godhead. But I think there'll be an ISKCON in the heavenly planets. Because, you know, many devotees, all of us, you know, we maintain to some degree, until we're completely pure, we maintain to some degree some aspiration to enjoy the material world. And of course, due to piety and devotional credits, the heavenly planets are there, available to the devotee, even if they do not make it all the way. So he jokes, you know, I think there'll be an ISKCON in the heavenly planets. So truth must be our goal. If we attempt to maintain illusions of optimism about the material energy, we're just delaying our disappointment, really. Because sooner or later the reality is going to drive home with death, old age. Our passions will fade, along with that, our enthusiasms. our senses will become weak, and our fame and influence and general usefulness, that will also wane with old age. You know, the new generation will come in. The old and worn body will remain. And the new generation will come in, youthful, full of vigor and enthusiasm, sweep aside the older generation. You guys are past your use-by date. And they will be very optimistic about the same things we're optimistic about. As young people, always optimistic. And they'll be hypnotized by this illusory optimism. And the old people, they're sitting on their rocking chairs saying, "Be warned, young ones. Be warned. It's not all it's cracked up to be." But the young are uninterested to hear all that. So, part of Krishna consciousness is to understand, Krishna consciousness being God consciousness, and God consciousness means to see things from the perspective of the absolute truth, to understand things as they are. And part of the part of God consciousness is to see the ghastly form of material nature as she is. Sometimes Prabhupada uses that term, the ghastly form of material nature. When you strip away the desire and aspiration for material happiness, you see the ghastly form, just like Arjuna saw the universal form, and he said, "Krishna, I see all the soldiers rushing into your mouths and being crushed between your teeth." You know, that you can imagine some, this big crushing, and all the soldiers are rushing in, smashed between their teeth. You know, this is the ghastly form of material nature. Sometimes the wheel of time. This is verses in the Bhagavatam where it talks about the wheel of time crushing the living entity. Can you imagine being like slowly rolled over by a steamroller from the feet up, crushed? So Bhagavatam uses these analogies to strip away the illusion of the material energy. And many meditations are there, like the forest of material desire, material enjoyment, you know, the illusions of family life and family happiness. Many illustrations are there. Because in this material world, ultimately, all the self-centered living entities, they're feeding off one another. That's the reality. One time, Devamrita Swami was walking with his disciple, he's my godbrother, and he told me of the story. You know, he's walking along the beach, this is when he's first coming along, and they were, you know, it was up in Hamilton, New Zealand, nice beach. And they're walking along, and then some people walking along, "How do you do?" You know, in the morning, "Lovely day, isn't it?" And Devamrita Swami said, "Nice day? What's nice about it?" So some people might think, well, that's not a very healthy psychological, that's not a healthy attitude towards life. What's nice about it? But his point was valid, you know, for the truth seeker. And for example, people like to walk in the forest, the beautiful forest. But what is that forest? Really, if you really analyze it, it's a great struggle for existence. Great struggle for existence. The birds eating the insects, what are they called? Rodents eating the birds, everybody eating the trees, everybody trying to survive. You know, why is there thorns on roses so they can, you know, protect themselves? It's a great struggle for existence. Birth, death, old age, and disease going on constantly, in a constant cycle, a constant struggle. One living entity is a food for another. And the elements, you know, we live in a very air-conditioned world these days. Very air-conditioned world, but you know, you can imagine being in the Middle Ages, say in England, you know, living in a hut or a hovel, or even in London, you know, in stone buildings. And winter, it snows there in winter. Very cold. And you know, they don't have foam mattresses, you know, sprayed out of some machine, and they puff up and they're all perfectly even. You know, they've got like, they've got to get like lamb's wool and make it into a thing, and it's infested with lice, of course. And, you know, the clothes are very rough on the skin. The flour, it's stone ground, it's full of grit. Huh? The, you know, it's freezing cold. You have to go out and grow your food. If there's a drought, if the fields become swamped by overwater, there's no food, there's diseases. You know, you don't have toothpaste and electric toothbrushes. And, you know, so people's teeth wear out on the rough food. Incredible hardship and suffering. Huh? People didn't live that long because it was so hard. You know, you had to be strong to survive. You know, even these days, you know, with our air conditioning and central heating, hundreds and thousands of people die in England every winter. But we're kind of insulated from that with our technological advancement. But actually, the material world is quite an intense place. A lot of hardship goes on. And you see that the living entities are trying to exploit one another. You can see this on an animal level. For example, the praying mantis. Praying mantis is a type of insect. It's bigger. Got big barbs on these long arms, and it kind of prances around. Like something from Aliens or something like that. Quite a sort of sinister looking creature. And the female is much bigger than the male. And of course they come together to mate. And then the female destroys and eats the male. Destroys and eats the male. That's the nature. Or a cat, you know. The cat is so sweet and you're stroking your cat. But the cat has an instinct to kill. You know, you see a cat when it gets the hunter mode, it switches into hunter mode, you just see it get this look of determination on its face that's kind of like scary. The way it sort of hunts and chases, it's not thinking about anything else, just predator mode. And if that cat was bigger, it would eat you. You know, if it gets into the mood, it would eat you. Huh? That's what happens. You know, there's stories of, you know, like, Westerners who settled in somewhere like Africa, and they're out hunting, and the husband shot a lioness, and then they discovered, oh, the lioness had cubs. What are these cubs going to do? Oh, and they take them and they look after them. And very quickly these cubs grow older, you know. And it's like, you know, they're living in this is like South Africa, so they've got African slaves and so forth. And the African slaves are thinking, what are you doing? This is crazy, you know. You know, this lion, these lion cubs growing up and just wandering around freely. Huh? And of course, you know, after some time, they become, you know, they're just playing, you know, and they just swipe you, but they swipe you with their paw. Sometimes they forget to retract their claws and gash you open, or they knock you over. You know, so powerful, powerful creatures, you know. I mean, a lion can fit your head in its mouth. Powerful killing machine. So, you know, the lions grow up, and then, you know, of course, the inevitable happens. The lion gets fired up one day and, like, butchers one of the African slaves, you know. And then they have to kill it, you know. Because this is the nature of the living entity. Depending on the body, they have this instinct, which is for self-preservation above and all, over and above everything else. We see that living entities in this world feed off one another. We can see this in all human dealings as well. Like, for example, the children, as we see in this verse about children, they have the tendency to exploit the parents. What? To get things out of the parents. Even marketers know this these days. Millions and millions of dollars are spent on psychoanalysis to understand how to influence the child through ads and so forth, creating these intricate, you know, ads that just enchant the child and draw them in. And the whole idea is that the child will then hassle the mother, hassle the father like anything. I want this. And if they don't get it, throw a tantrum. The whole thing's designed to manipulate the parent through the child. And the children know this intuitively. Like, I'm sure many of us had very loving mothers, you know, whose love was so strong, but also a little bit maybe perhaps sentimental, to the point where if you were upset, they would do anything to try and stop you being upset. And then the child learns how to manipulate this, and they do emotional blackmail. They withhold the love from the mother until they get what they want. You know, you see this in children. In very cunning children, they learn to do this very expertly. And then that carries on as the child grows older. As they do it older, you know, as one gets older, they also continue this these various techniques to manipulate the parents. And you see that oftentimes when parents get very old, then they have become a burden. You know, many times, especially in the West, they'll push them into a old people's home, visit them very occasionally, because they're an inconvenience now. And the you know, also, you know, it's amazing, the human mind will be thinking, you know, yeah, I love my mother, I love my father, but they're a bit of a burden now. You know, they've got so much money. You know, one day they'll die and I'll get that money. That'll be good. You know, and then the human mind might catch itself. It's like, oh, that's a horrible thing to think. But this is the nature of the mind. This is the nature of the conditioned soul. And even when men and women come together in this world, due to the amorous attractions, you know, they are wanting things from one another. They're wanting things from one another. That's why they come together. They say, I want something from you, you want something from me. Let's make a deal. I mean, of course, they never say that. It's all dressed up in, you know, sentiments and romance and so forth. But even if you read these books, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, any relational psychology book, you can see that that's what's going on. They basically teach you how to get what you want from the other person without frying them out. Or to make them give you what you want, to make them want you to give what you want. Basically, it's a techniques for sustainable exploitation. You know, so we can continue in this mood and both feel good about it. You know, both get what we want. But that's what's going on. They'll teach the woman, you know, how to ask of your husband in such a way that it draws upon his, it motivates his masculine ego. You know, he feels, oh, yes, I want to do that. You know, he feels like heroic, and you know, it teaches the woman that, and it teaches the man how to emotionally gratify that woman, so he can do what, you know, he can entertain his program. You know, so she'll surrender to his passions. This is what's taught in these books. And it's just, I mean, it's all dressed up in nicety, and we all have a right for loving relationships and this and that. But then when you strip it back, you can kind of see. This is really what's going on in the material world. The living entities are feeding off one another. And even if you see this, if you come into some desperate situation, let's say the plane crashed, we're on a plane, and the plane crashed in Antarctica or something, and this has happened, you know. And then eventually, you know, everybody gets so hungry. You know, you remember Roadrunner, the cartoon. Roadrunner will be running along, and then Wile E. Coyote will be looking, and he'll be watching Roadrunner through his binoculars or whatever, his telescope. And then he'll suddenly see that Roadrunner is no longer a, you know, bird running along, but he's just like this roast turkey running along. He just visualizes the flesh, you know, because he's got his own appetites, his passion. So he just sees this roast turkey and he thinks, yes. So, you know, after a few days of being starving, you know, the living entities start to look at each other, and they see the flesh of the body. And their hunger's burning inside them, and that's what they see. They see, well, that's edible. You know, we've got to eat something. That's edible. And then they, you know, they might even, you know, if somebody is dead, they might eat that person, or they might even, you know, band together and kill one person. You know, so this is when it comes down to it. The living entity is essentially wanting to maintain oneself. Yeah. This is what the Bhagavad Gita is pointing out about the material world. And those who are aspiring for truth will appreciate these truths because they help them. But those who are still wanting to enjoy the material world, they can potentially find truths like this very distasteful. Right? It's depressing. So the question becomes, you know, if we are on the path of trying to understand the absolute truth, and we've got to deal with these inconvenient truths, how to accept them maturely? I mean, this is the doubt that people have. You know, if I'm going to see a certain reality about family life and things like that, how am I ever going to have balanced family life? You know, this in the early days of ISKCON, this has been pointed out by Ravindra Swarup and mature devotees, that in the early days of family life, they didn't know how to do it. They're all about being detached. Mothers, don't become attached to your children. Husbands, don't become attached to wives. Wives, don't become attached to husbands. And therefore, they're completely socially dysfunctional. Didn't work. Huh? So there has to become some kind of balance for actually things to go on. And this is why when people look at these verses, sometimes they say negative, it's impractical, it's unhealthy. No, but there is a way to integrate it. To integrate reality, and at the same time function in the world in a healthy way. That's possible, and that's what we're trying to do in Krishna consciousness. All devotees have different degrees of acceptance of truth and also realization of truth, and we have to be sensitive about that. Especially, you know, when preaching to others, we have to be aware of their digestive power. You know, how much truth can they digest at this particular time? You know, many times if you preach too strongly to somebody in the beginning, they get indigestion. They think this is too much, too negative, and they freak out, and it gives them a bad taste, and they leave. At the same time, so we need to be sensitive, but at the same time we don't just want to avoid the truth. Because eventually we need to accept truth. If we're really going to make it back to Godhead, if we're really going to become enlightened, we need to assimilate truth into our life. And that has to be done gradually. So there's various symptoms that of indigestion of truth that, you know, you see in young devotees. That it's like sometimes you see bitterness. It's kind of material life. It's just it's all disgusting. Ugh, real just kind of distaste. At the same time there's a bitterness there because kind of like, you can kind of see that there. You see they've still got desires to enjoy. But the fact is, and they're really bitter that they can't enjoy it because they've seen some things and they're just bitter about it. You know, it's just like you know, often see in old people, you know, they've tried to enjoy, marriage is broken up, they might have married again and broke up again, and they're kind of old and bitter. You know, I tried to enjoy, and then they talk to the young people, you know. Yeah, it's all nonsense, you know. You'll realize you'll become bitter like me one day, cynical, you know. Or angry, you know. It might even at some point where like, why can't I enjoy it? Like one devotee told me once, you know, he counsels a lot of devotees when they're first coming along. And he said, you know, yeah, people come to me with so many issues. You know, doubts and things about Krishna consciousness. And you know what I've realized? It all boils down to one point. Why won't Krishna let me enjoy? You know, I want to enjoy, but Krishna won't let me enjoy. It all boils down to this one point. And what is that point? Ultimately, it's envy. So these are different symptoms that arise. Sometimes devotees become depressed, or people looking at the reality of the world, because, you know, philosophers have stated, you know, humanity is, human society in general is necessarily mad. Because if we were to really acknowledge the realities of existence, everybody would just be depressed and morose. Huh? And that's why depression is so prominent, and therefore they say, just take this drug and forget about it, you know. So you've got the people that are necessarily mad and just like, oh yeah, it's all great, you know, chill world, whoa, so much opportunity. Not really looking at the reality. And then you've got people who look at the reality and also go mad because they've got no alternative. They just get depressed. So you get depression and inertia. Sometimes, you know, like, you just can't get fired up about anything because you kind of, you know, you just analyze the whole thing from beginning to end, you know, and then you think, well, what's the point of even starting? And you just become inert. So like every time you want to do something, it's just like, oh yeah, but it's just a waste of time in the material world, you know. You kind of become morose. So there's different stages that devotees go through. You can kind of, if you've been around for a little while, you can begin to see this. And you can begin to see this different stages of maturing and accepting the realities of the material energy. It starts with ignorance. You know, you come in and you're ignorant. You're just like, oh, yeah, tear the way. What? You know, you haven't seen the wheel of time crushing you. You might be young and enthusiastic, so you're ignorant. And then some knowledge comes along and you deny it. No! You know? Can't be true. No! It's just like a denier. And then you might start to accept some truths about the material world and you become self-righteous. Huh? Yeah, the material world's bogus. And all the material people are there just idiots, you know? You become self-righteous. But I know better. I've got knowledge. I'm a devotee. Huh? And then what sits in after that is kind of a disgust with the material world. Actually, you know, you really start to perceive some realities of the conditioned souls and the realities of material energy, become disgusted with it. Oh, this is disgusting. And then it might come to another point where you really start to become introspective and you become disgusted with yourself. You know, I'm full of so many disgusting desires. You become disgusted. You know, there's one devotee coming along at the moment and he was saying, yeah, he was getting some realization about this, about, you know, the nature of his heart and the nature of, you know, the heart of his mother, for example. And he just became really disgusted with himself and with her, and he's just like, this kind of makes the whole thing quite dysfunctional, you know. So there's some genuine realization going on there, but at the same time it's not yet functional. It hasn't been properly integrated. And then you have a gradual withdrawal of investment in the material energy. But that has to be coupled with an investment in Krishna consciousness. So as one invests more in devotional service, one's investment in material life, one's desire to be fulfilled by the material energy becomes less. There's less investment there. And therefore one becomes more peaceful. And it's like, yeah, the material energy is like that, but I'm not depending on it for fulfillment. This is the beginning of really maturing. And then becomes a kind of an acceptance. You know, you understand what is the nature of the spirit soul. You also understand what is the human condition. And you accept that this is human nature. And then you become eventually duty conscious. Just according to Dharma, you act in the material world without attachment. Prabhupada says, disinterested obligatory duties. So you do your family life, whatever, and you do it nicely in the mode of goodness according to Dharma, and everybody's satisfied. But at the same time, you're not really attached to it. You do it according to Dharma. What is your allegiance? Your allegiance is to Krishna, because Dharma means Krishna's law. So you're doing it just out of love for Krishna. You still act in the material world properly, but you're not invested there. And this time you're integrated. Because, you know, all these bitterness or anger or envy, you know, they're all useless. All you're doing is beating yourself up and tying yourself in knots, because there's no point in being angry or bitter about the nature of things. The nature of things are going to remain. The principles or the laws of material nature, you don't break them. You break yourselves against them. You break yourself against the laws. So better to just accept them, because it's Krishna's design. He even says in Bhagavad Gita, stamps it certified material world. Akalayam, ashashvitam. It's temporary, it's miserable. No secrets, you know. This is the nature of the material world, certified. So why be bitter about that? You know, it's the nature of things. Better to understand the bigger picture and seek fulfillment in the spiritual energy. And that's what, for the devotee, Krishna is the alternative investment for the heart. You know, you see Krishna, he's standing on the altar, he's blissful. You know, he's the father of every living entity. They're all rebelling against him, well, not all of them, but a quarter. according to the Acharyas, a quarter of the living entities are rebellious in the material energy. And they are, trying to, use Krishna's energy for their own enjoyment. But Krishna has reconciled that within himself. You know, he's peaceful about it. Let them do it. Eventually they can come back, He's blissful, he's not so concerned. I mean, of course he would like the living entities to come back. But he's eternally blissful. And same the devotees, they meditate upon Krishna. Gradually they take on Krishna's point of view as well. It's like, yes, the material energy, it's full of problems, but it actually ultimately doesn't affect the soul. They become Krishna conscious, they become peaceful. And invested in Krishna, they're no longer invested in the material energy. So, this is the Vedic life. And we read the Vedic epics like Mahabharata, which these verses have connection with. And we see that why are they epic? There's many books on war and, passions and so forth. Rebellion and civil war and, fighting and all that stuff. Great. What's epic about that? For the enlightened person, there's nothing epic about that. But what is epic about Mahabharata is the battle between passion and righteousness. You see the Pandavas and so forth, they refuse, especially Yudhisthira, they refuse to surrender to their passions. And they simply say, what is the Dharma? What is the proper thing to do? And they discipline themselves, they resist the temptation to fall into Adharma. And they fight this constant battle within themselves, disciplining themselves. And this is the real battle. Gandhi said, famously, that the real war is not to be fought on the outside world. The real war has to be fought inside the heart and the mind. So this is the epic battle of life. And just trying in this battle to do the right thing, to follow Dharma, to fulfill Krishna's will, to have allegiance to Krishna even when your passion is pulling at you, this is glorious. And this is what really satisfies the heart. At the end of the day, if you go to bed and you lie down and you think, I tried my best to serve Krishna properly today, you feel satisfied even if you fail to do it perfectly. But I tried my best. You'll be satisfied just with that goal of trying to maintain allegiance to the Lord. And what we'll find, in the end, our passions will fade. The transcendental reality will become more realized to us. And then we'll be satisfied. Because as we see, lasting fame, like the fame of the Pandavas, lasting fame, not infamy, but fame, comes to people who resist becoming overwhelmed by passions. Because everybody's becoming overwhelmed by passions, even the great intellectuals, the artists, the great generals, the great men and women of the world, they're all becoming overwhelmed by passions and the material energy. But the real lasting fame comes to those who resist that and maintain the righteous or stand firm on higher principles. That's really the lasting glory. So how to do it? Basically, we've got to develop our spiritual intelligence, our determination through our sadhana and so forth. But also we can do it by guidance. Guidance is a big part of it, especially when one is young and not full of knowledge, as most of us here are not. We have to take shelter of Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. You have to understand what is the Shastra conjunctions. You have to take shelter of your spiritual master. And you have to have association with determined, serious devotees. If you do that, the struggle to stand firm on higher principles is much easier. And I can just think of one example. I can think of many examples, but I'll give one example just to finish. Like one devotee, she became very enamored. By some young man, and vice versa. This happened. And, you know, same time they wanted to be good devotees. So they approached the spiritual master. And the spiritual master, simply by having the higher intelligence, the higher perspective, he was able to cut that illusion out. And what he said, look, he said, the seasons will pass. The pull of the seasons, the tug of the seasons, you know, because now you're in a certain season of life, you're feeling certain desires, certain pushings. Those will pass. Marriage is a different thing. It concerns 30 or 40 years of your life. So based on passing enthusiasms, you don't want to dive into something. You know, you've got, you want to be a bit more intelligent about that. And because of this guidance, the person was able to again fix up their mind, again fix on their more long-term determination, and make a proper decision, and approach the whole thing in a much more intelligent way. So guidance should be there, and that's what we see. Akrura is giving guidance to Dhritarashtra, just out of duty, he's giving the guidance, and unfortunately, Dhritarashtra can't accept it because of his great attachment. He doesn't have sufficient strength of mind to overcome his attachment at this stage. And also he keeps deferring to destiny. Oh, I'd love to follow your instructions, they're so nectar. But destiny's got me. What can I do? But we should try and not be like that, you know, we should try and be more intelligent. So yeah, these are some points that arise when meditating on these verses. So, thank you. Is there any questions or comments? Yes,
I was wondering how often the offspring of a fish drink up the water, because a lot of it can evaporate.
I don't know, actually. I was wondering about that myself. Do fish drink water? I mean, they're soaking it all day. Bhagavatam says so. So we'll take that. I mean, the main thing is the example, the idea. We can take that. I don't know. I don't know the details about the habits of fish.
They can certainly, because they are growing. Growth you need a lot of moisture.
Yeah.
Water and minerals.
Yeah.
And all those things.
But I do know in descriptions of autumn, Prabhupada gives the example of the fish in the pond who doesn't see that the waters that he's sitting in are evaporating. Huh? By the hot sun, the waters are evaporating, and slowly his little pond is getting smaller and smaller, and soon he'll just be lying on the muddy bank, unable to breathe. And he says this is like the conditioned soul, where the time is drying up.
Yeah.
Any other comments? Thank you very much, Gancharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki.
Yeah.